Hola, Sol. So the reason why I continue to lead 8-week retreats now that I've really taught everything I know and more. And really, the podcasts, they're all there, you know, especially from last year, but also Araluen. I mean, we covered everything. So in terms of information, there's really not much more, really, maybe no more. So why do it? And it's very simple. I'm regarding these 8-week retreats as basic training, like in the military, it's basic training to prepare people for going into long-term retreat, finding the path, proceeding along the path, and coming to its culmination. That's why. Yeah. If I didn't feel that that can happen in the future, then I would really just encourage people to listen to podcasts or the online courses, and I'll spend 8 weeks in solitary retreat and be a very happy camper. But that's why. It's very simple. Yeah. And so, in this regard then, we have what we can all do when we go home, we can all do without exception, is we can apply all the Dharma that we know to daily life. And that absolutely includes the three outer preliminaries, the three inner preliminaries. That's absolutely hands-on to be fully integrated, to transform everything, to revolutionize your way of viewing reality. As you're going to the bank and going shopping and dealing with kids and grandchildren and all that kind of jazz, transform it all. So this is complete integratable. I love the 7-point mind training because it's a basket that holds all of this and integrates everything. It's marvelous. But it's all the teachings you received, and many of you have received a lot. But it all comes to a fulcrum. I think that's the word I want. Where all the teachings, like an hourglass, all the sand is then coming to one place and it funnels through there. All these teachings, to my mind, funnel to the point that you're really ready to get onto the path and then proceed from there. It seems like everything is about that. And from the teachings I've received, beginning with Geshe Ngan Taike and Geshe Rabten and His Holiness, and the list goes on and on and on, very much including the teachings from Gyatso Rinpoche, the shamatha is really it's the on-ramp. I've used this analogy very often. If you want to go on a freeway to get from here to, let's say, from Pisa to Roma, then there has to be a motorway, yeah? an autostrada. But there is a way to get onto it, the on-ramp, right? But once you're on it, then you just go, right? So the on-ramp to the path, the Lamboche, the great path, which is the freeway, it's the highway, it's the autostrada, it is shamatha, which enables you to get into the fast lane and just streak right the way through. You know, put on your yellow blinker, bing, 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 get out of the way, I'm going. You know, I've been in Germany, that's what it's like. You know, the people with the really nice cars, they get in the fast lane and say, everybody else, move to the side, because there's no speed limit here. It's very cool, you know. I was in a $300,000 Porsche in that context. I wasn't driving. But I saw, this is how the other 1% lives. And so, shamatha, so everything kind of comes to the fulcrum of shamatha. And shamatha, unlike most, if not all, the other practices, it's number one, it's very transitional. It's just a phase. And then you don't focus on shamatha anymore. You use shamatha for everything else you will do. It's a phase. Prior to that, you have everything else. And you can integrate that with a full family, full-time job, and so forth and so on. And then after that, you apply your shamatha to everything, whether it's something really sleek and really simple, like Vipassana Tekchut Turtgil, or it's more elaborate. Either way, it's your call. But the shamatha changes everything. It brings everything to a different level. And this is not an opinion. It's just right back to the Buddha himself and Buddhaghosa and Padmasambhava and Tsongkhapa, all the great voices, are saying the same thing. And for that little transitional phase, as brief as possible, frankly, as efficient, as brief as possible, to not dilly-dally around, not make that string on for years and years and years, but just get the job done, you know. Then for that phase, you have the outer and the inner. And it's very clear, and it's been known for hundreds of years. And the outer is, for that phase, you really want a conducive environment. It's like a premature baby, you know, that's come out, let's say, 2 months early. For a little while, that baby needs to be in a very, very carefully controlled environment. Really carefully control, and just let the baby get through that, and then, you know, and then slowly the baby is just, you know, bouncing around like any other kid and doing just fine. But for a little while, you need that very special environment, and if you don't get it, the baby probably won't make it. And if you don't get it, if you don't have the environment and you're practicing shamatha, it's going to be tough. I won't say it can't be done, but it will be tough, right? So what's the outer environment? It's something pretty simple. So I haven't memorized this verbatim, but the essence of it is very straightforward. The outer environment is peaceful. It's healthy. It's beautiful. That is pleasing to your mind, pleasing to your heart and mind. Food is easily available. It's not dangerous, like from, you know, poisonous this, poisonous that, or, you know, men, violent men and so forth. It's not dangerous. You can be really at ease, feeling safe and relaxed because it's not dangerous. You'd like to have good companions. Good companions. If you're really a seasoned meditator, then just going totally solo is fine. That's fine. But if you're not so seasoned, not so well in the groove, then having a few companions, and here's what the classic teachings say, is sharing similar view and similar practice. Just because it makes things go smoother, you know. That maybe three or four, you're all in shamatha practice. You're there with a shared vision. You all totally get it. And a shared view that you're not going to be debating things. Like we're just here. We're in a family here. And so I've heard this not just in the oral transmission, that three or four people is kind of like a little pod of good friends. And it should have they should not be complicated with any kind of romantic stuff going. So if it's very straightforward, no rants going, then men and women is fine. But if there's proclivity, because all kinds of stuff comes up in a retreat, then better just men and women, just to keep things simple. Just keep things simple, because what you don't need, I've seen this happen, what you don't need is a romance and shamatha practice going at the same time. One of them is going to give way to the other. And you can probably figure out which one. So in a shamatha practice, you just want to be just totally focused. And if there are people there, if it's just a brother-sister relationship, mother-child, family, then it's fine, because it's not about gender, it's about desire, you know? Keep it simple. But having a few people, not 20, but, you know, like three or four, that you know you're there as a family, and if one of them trips, the others are right there to pick you up. And if you trip, they're there to help you. So you're not there to chat, you don't have social gatherings and so forth. You may only speak once every 2 weeks, but you know that if you run into trouble, they're right there, you know, having that. And so as we envision, you know, up on the hill of Castellina Marittima, the property there, we would like to have 20 cabins. And they would be clustered in little groups of four or five. And so those would be kind of the family units, you know, where everybody knows each other. They're totally there for each other. And then the broader community, then of course, but looser relationship. But closer relationship with the people right in your pod, that would be ideal. And then, of course, having a teacher there can just make things faster. The teacher, as His Holiness said, can save you a lot of time. So that's for the outer. And they say, few people during the daytime and few dogs at night. Which we've just ruled out India. Bye-bye, India. You know, I've spent 6 years. I know what I'm talking about. Show me the place. It's really healthy. Easy access to food, no dogs barking at night, no people chatting, and no radios, boomboxes, and so forth. Okay, go ahead, give me the list. Go ahead, I'm ready, give me the list. And Nepal, the same thing, you know. And so it's not easy. But what I found now, having led people in long-term retreats now for about going on 10 years, is that those places you just don't bump into. By and large, you don't find them. Not in India, not in Nepal, not in North America, not in South America. Oh, now that we're in the 21st century, oh, by the way, money shouldn't be a problem. If you're absolutely devoted to the practice, then you shouldn't have to come out of retreat because you run out of money. That sucks. That's like a violation of reality. That should never happen. Totally dedicated practitioner, doing really well in practice, and sorry, but now I'm going to starve. That should never happen. And another, so that's kind of 21st century, because we're not living in a Buddhist country. Sri Lanka, no problem, I've lived there. If you're a yogi living in full-time retreat, you are covered for life. Doesn't even come up. If you're in Tibet, I spoke with an outstanding Kempo there. If you're in Tibet now, and you're a yogi or yogini like that, you are covered. People are going to be crowding around to take care of you. You don't even have to think about it, right? we shouldn't have to think about it here in Italy or in Brazil, Australia, North America, and so forth. We shouldn't have to think about it. Those people should be covered. They're the cheapest date you'll ever find. You know, I mean, it's 10 euros. 10 euros a day. Really, right? If you don't have to pay rent, and one way or another, your health is covered. Hopefully you just, keep healthy. But for food and utilities, 10 euros, 15 maximum. That's it. So money should not be an issue, not be a concern. Not be a concern when I come out of retreat, then what'll happen? Not be a concern. So you just don't have to give it any thought at all. I know for myself, the greatest luxury I feel about money is not to have to think about it. And if I don't have to think about it, that's all I want of money. That's a lot. A lot of people have to think about money. And I feel tremendously privileged. I just don't have to at all. Period. And that's all I want. So, and then there's one other one in the 21st century, and oh, it's a big one, because I've been attending to this a lot. Your visa doesn't run out. It totally sucks. 3 months, 6 months, you have to go to another country in order to get back in again. Maybe they won't let you back in again. That's why I'm not even considering the United States, my beloved homeland. It's a gorgeous country, and lots of open space. Lots and lots of open space. Magnificently beautiful space. I love the country. California alone is magnificent, but there's zero chance of getting long-term visas. I've checked and checked and checked. There's no way. Long-term visas for non-Americans, even Canadians, I think is hard, let alone anybody else. So not even looking. So those are the outer circumstances. That's the outer mandala. And if things go on the track that we are watching right now, I think in 2 years we may have it going. 2 years. Next year acquisition, next year building, and then we may have it up and running. So the outer mandala will be there. And then we turn, okay, what's the inner mandala? It's not just, I really, really, really want to. That's, well, a lot of people would want to. That's not enough. That's not even remotely enough. And so the inner mandala. So this is what I'm going to mention these right now, because we can cultivate them here today and in 5 minutes and in 10 minutes, and we can cultivate them in 3 weeks, and we can cultivate them in 2 months. These can be cultivated at all times, and the more they're cultivated, when we're not in retreat, then when we go into retreat, it's going to be smooth transition, just slipping right in, like a seal on an ice floe that just slips right off the ice, and it's just swimming so easily, just like that. And so what are they? The first two are really the ones that catch the attention. Dut Nyung Chokshe. And that is, we'll focus on being in retreat. Here's the inner mandala. You've just entered retreat. It's your first day. Dut-nyung means that you have few desires. Few desires. And so there you are. You have very few desires for things that are not there. Okay? And there's an awful lot that's not there. Because you've got a room. It should be comfortable, clean, neat, easy access to food, and basically no entertainment. Pretty much, your entertainment is looking out on that, but from a better view, because it's 500 meters higher. That's your entertainment, is the beauty of the mountains, the clouds, the birds, the fragrances in the air, and so that's your entertainment, right? You want entertainment? Look out the window. That's it. So, and then for food, not desiring things you don't have. Not desiring, just that you have very few desires. If you don't have that quality, you will not succeed in Tibet or in retreat, and it doesn't matter how well you know how to practice shamatha or how much you want to practice shamatha. If you have a lot of desires, it's just going to scatter you all over the place. And after a while, you just get so agitated, hell with it, I want to go back and have fun. And then I'll think about retreat as something really nice to do, but not in it. So that's the first one. And then the second one is Chokshe. These are two sides of the same coin, and Chokshe is contentment. And that is whatever you do have, the quality of your food, the quality of your accommodation, the quality of the environment, the quality of your companions, the quality of your teacher, the quality of everything around you, that you're just content. So you look at what you do have, and you're content. And in terms of what you don't have, you have few desires. That's quite clear, yeah? So what are you attending to? What I do have, and this is enough. Chokshe, this is enough. It can always be better, of course, but this is enough. And so, and then very few excursions to what you don't have. So those are the two big ones. So can we cultivate that? This means that you're content. You have few desires. When you have almost no hedonia, almost no pleasant stimulation coming in to jazz things up, make things exciting, entertaining, give you pleasure, you know, the addiction to the stimulation and to all that stuff. Now you've gone into a cell. Can you be content and have few desires where almost everybody around you, they're getting through the day by always going outwards for this, that, and the other thing, movie, music, internet, text message, friends, gossiping, parties, just anything. And they've got all these props. They've got 1,000 props to hold up their happiness hedonically. You know, they got 1,000 of them. And I think most people are not only accustomed to it, but they're addicted to it. And so, as you know, many of you know the story of people trying to sit for 15 minutes with no stimulation. They'd rather have electric shocks. Yeah, it's a scientific study. It was done. Two-thirds of the men would rather have an electric shock than sit quietly with their own minds for 15 minutes, and one-quarter of the women. So that shows the level of addiction. So this is not 15 minutes in solitude. This is like longer. And can you be content? And can you have few desires? So there's two. The third one, crucially important, without it, you may as well just forget it, and that is pure ethical discipline. If you have precepts, you keep all of them. And whatever precepts you do or do not have, you are constantly, continuously in a flow of nonviolence and benevolence in all of your interactivity with everyone around you. And there are no exceptions. With birds, with insects, with people, your friends, your fellow meditators, villagers who might come in, so anybody around, it's just, that's all you do. It's always nonviolent by means of body, speech, and mind, no movement towards harm, and benevolence. And that's just where you live. That's what you display, according to the Dolgya Dhammas, that's what you display to the world. They might, the people around in the surrounding village and so forth, they may not have a clue what you're doing. But if they learn about what's going on, they say, well, those people are really very peaceful. And they treat the environment gently, right? They touch the environment gently, very green. Very green. Tibet, all of Tibet was green before the modernity came in, before the Chinese came in. They just started beating the crap out of the place. It was all green. There were no green places in Tibet because it was all green. You know, it was all balanced. They could have lived there for 1,000 years with that way of life, and it wouldn't have touched the environment. So that's how it should be. And so the pure ethics, without that, then there's just no reason to go on at all. You may just pack up and stop. So that's the third one. The fourth one is Dunyung Janyung. Having few concerns and few activities. This is now very specifically for shamatha, because the whole idea is that now, like rubbing two sticks together to get fire, you do it continuously until the flame of shamatha bursts into light and you achieve shamatha. But you maintain the continuity every day, throughout the day. Just you keep on rubbing. You warm up. You proceed along the nine stages. You achieve shamatha, and then you got flame, and now you're finished with shamatha. You just maintain it. But for that time, you're just really cutting down to absolute minimum your concerns about family and people. Oh, what's she doing? She's in retreat. How's she doing? Why isn't she Skyping? What about email? Is she joined a cult? Blah blah blah. You know. And your investment portfolio and all the other stuff, you cut it to absolute minimum, just down to bare subsistence. So Dunyung, very few concerns. You won't even do it at a level, of course I have a lot of things I need to do, email and trying to set up the Kastalina and all of that, but even the little bit amount that I'm checking out the internet for, you know, what's happening in the world, don't need it. The world will get along without you for 6 months, 9 months. Don't go there, you know. You know what's going on. You know exactly what's going on. It's called samsara. And it's every day the same. It's the same, really. In the big picture, it's the same. It's just an ocean of suffering. And not getting worded, not getting better, just overall, you know, canceled all out. It's just samsara. And you know that's there. And you know the intense urgency to come out and be of service. But first, you need to simplify radically with few concerns and few activities. So your activities here, a little bit of reading yet, but only to support your practice, not as a diversion, entertainment, oh, I'm tired of practicing, let's read something. Yeah, it's just a distraction, right? So if you do some reading, excellent, but it's all for the sake of your practice. And then, of course, it's probably going to be some time before you're meditating 14 hours a day, 16 hours a day, when you're more like at 8 or 10, where you still have quite a few hours left over, then you need to fill that time. And then you fill that time in ways that are very grounding. So gardening would be very good. Walking, of course. But if you want to do something constructive, well, clean your room, do your laundry, prepare meals. You'll be preparing your own meals, so prepare nice little simple meals, but tasty. But gardening could be good if there are orchards, if there's clearing of the paths, you know, just basic things that keep you grounded and do not give you food for rumination. So anything with the earth, grounding, coming back to nature, taking care of the premises, taking care of the whole place as if it's your own home, because it actually is, that we will not have any gardeners coming in to take care of us. We'll not have any cooks coming in to take care of us. We're not going to have people coming in to take care of, we're not aristocrats here. We're yogis and we'll be taking care of ourselves. And that's how we keep the cost really low. We'll do our own laundry, we do our own food, and we'll have somebody to bring food. And that should be really simple. And we'll get into a routine. You know exactly what food you need, you buy it, you've got it for a week. You've got a refrigerator, keep it cool. And so, simple. Get the routine down. You know, I've done this. Get the routine down, you don't have to think about it. It's just there. And then the final one's the clincher. Yeah, there are five, and this is the fifth one. And it rolls off my tongue. I've been saying that for decades now. Drabalasope namdo means this namdo vikalpa, you remember that? Obsessive, compulsive, you know, blah, blah, blah of the mind, involving desires and so on. Regarding that, I think you know what I'm talking about? It rings a bell? Patrice, but everybody else besides Patrice. So the rambling mind, he said, totally abandon it. The guillotine. Bring on the Marie Antoinette of vikalpa. Off with her head. Just cut it out. Just cut it out. In a very, very friendly and absolutely persevering way, no tolerance. And that is, I have no time for this crap. Any more than you're heading out on a drive, you have no time to put sugar in your gas tank. You might be tempted to on occasion. But don't put any sugar in your gas tank. It will not work out well. It actually works out very badly. So gas tank, sugar, keep them totally separate. Your mind and namdo, totally separate. Namdo is sugar in your gas tank. It will make everything go badly. So you just break that habit completely. You wake up in the morning, use your mind constructively in any way you like. It's not don't think, it's just don't have diarrhea of the mind. What else do we call it? You know? Just establish a new baseline, that when you're walking, you're washing your clothes, you're eating, you're preparing food, and so forth, you're fully attentive to what you're doing there. And if thoughts come in, they're either coming in like cloud formations and they just drift off by themselves, or there's some thought that actually, oh, where did I leave the sponge? That's fine. Where did I leave the sponge? And then you find it. And then you put it down again, but you don't have the smog of that. You completely eradicate it. So that's that. So if we do succeed, we'll see. We don't know. A lot of variables, a lot of things beyond our control. But if we do, and then the time comes to fill those 20 cabins, then I can tell you, because I like to be transparent, I'll be the person to choose. And I will simply choose those people who I feel have the greatest likelihood of really getting tremendous benefit. So the whole notion of who's closer to, who are my older students, do I have closer students, more distant students, favorite students, not so favorite students, all of that is nothing. Torch it. It means nothing at all. Zero. Just telling you the truth. It means nothing. What does mean is, if people come there, is that do I have a sense there's a very great likelihood they'll benefit deeply. Really benefit deeply. Because if we do this in one place and we succeed, we actually have people achieving shamatha. You know, I can tell you who will be the first person to know outside of our group. Because he's very interested. Any guesses? Kimberly? Yeah, yeah. The last time I saw him in Strasbourg, the first thing he asked me, Alan, have any of your students achieved shamatha? First thing he asked me. There are not too many people teaching it. Seriously. First thing he asked me. And so we've not had the environment. It's difficult. I know very well how difficult it is without the suitable environment, without all of that. But if we get that together, then it's simply one question. His Holiness gave a name for a center that I tried to create in India, and so far there's just no support, but he gave a beautiful name for it. And it's Dingzen Gatse Ling. Dingzen Gatse Ling. Garden of Samadhi. Gatse is more like pleasure grove, or a garden of delight, a delightful garden of Samadhi. That was the name he gave it, the center. But it just doesn't look like it's coming to life for the time being, for a very simple reason, lack of support. Very simple reason. Lack of support from Tibetans and Indians. I'm astonished, but what can you say? And it's even directly under offices of Holiness. So then I figure, okay, it's time for a pizza effect. Remember the pizza effect? What I've been heard is true. Let's imagine it is true. That 100 years ago, pizza was leftovers. It's when a nice Italian family, when they had a nice, really nice meal, they had leftovers. They'd put it in the icebox or whatever. And the next day, say, what is the leftovers? Okay, well, we'll just roll out some pasta and throw it on and we'll eat it and get rid of our leftovers. And that was pizza. That's what I heard. It was leftover food. After, you know, the guests had come and gone, you have leftover food. And it's just whatever was there. Throw it on a pizza, bake it, probably turn out okay. Add lots of Parmigiano, it'd be fine. Yeah. And then some Italian emigrants went from Italy to America. And, you know, coming to America is a land of opportunity, want to make a living. They opened up their Italian restaurants and they thought, you know, we used to have mediocre pizza in Italy, but why don't we make it tasty? We can make some money. So they started making really tasty pizza. And that caught on. And eventually the word got back to Italy. They're making a lot of money in America making pizza. This is like leftovers. And it's really catching on. Let's make our own leftovers, but let's make them tastier. And so it went to America and then came back as the pizza effect. So if that's not true, I don't want to hear about it. Because it's too good a story not to be true. So if it's not true, just button up. Because I'm going to hold to that story very tightly. So what I'm not seeing happening, and it's India, Nepal, Bhutan, Sikkim, I'm just not seeing it happening. They're creating outstanding lamas without question, beyond my capacity, no question at all. But what I'm not seeing is creating those environments and offering the teachings and then carrying people through. I just don't see that. I don't know why. I have many ideas, but who cares? So let's start in Italy with the Samadhi effect. Do it here, but succeed. Succeed. And if we succeed, the word will go back to His Holiness. And we're not going to be highlighting egos, saying, oh, this person did, and then sending the name out of the sound waves. I'm really sick and tired of that. I don't think it serves Dharma very well at all. I think it's anti-celebrating individuals. I don't believe in it. I just don't believe in it. So if people achieve shamatha here, if you want to broadcast it, that's your business. But I will simply telling His Holiness that, yeah, we have a garden here and the crops are growing well. And that will inspire. So ending on this note, when Bodhidharma was first introduced into Tibet with the glory of Shantarakshita and other monks and other scholars and so forth, they brought in sublime Dharma, but there were tremendous obstacles, right? You all know the stories. Tremendous obstacles. So the SWAT team, that's one way of looking at it. I was going to say muscle. They brought in the muscle. They brought in Padmasambhava, great scholar to be sure, and great bodhisattva to be sure, great being, great mahasiddha to be sure. But above all, he was coming in invited as, not as a great scholar or as a great monk, he was invited in as a mahasiddha to deal with the problems so that the dharma that was already being brought could flourish, right? And clearly there were other great adepts, Vimalamitra, Vairotsana, Kamalashila, and so forth and so on. But Padmasambhava was like the magnificent figure there. That really he was the one that took these obstructive forces, and it wasn't violent, it was powerful. I don't know one case where he killed some demon, malevolent force. He subdued them, he transmuted them, he calmed them down. And then the Dharma could flourish, right? And so, needless to say, here in the 21st century, as wonderful Dharma is being introduced all over the world by outstanding teachers, Western, Tibetan, Bhutanese, and so forth, there are a lot of obstacles. That's obvious. But it's a big world. This was one little country. I mean, it's rather large in landmass, but small population. 6 million, maybe less back then, probably maybe half that. Who knows? I don't know. But one person, one person could play an enormously high impact role. One person. And then with Sami and then the branches going out, then tremendous, I mean, to change a whole civilization, right? So my sense is, in this 21st century where we're living now, I don't think one person would be enough. I think there need to be 100 Padmasambhavas. That's what I think. You know, more or less, give or take a couple. I think there need to be 100 Padmasambhavas from different countries and different genders and different backgrounds and different, but 100 Padmasambhavas. That's what I think. So we're not focusing on any individual. We're focusing on a movement of awakening. So for the contemplative observatory, we have to succeed in one place. If there were a better place than this, I would go there. Maybe I will if this doesn't work out. We need to succeed in one place. Get onto the on-ramp, onto the path, get onto the path, report to His Holiness. His blessings will be there all along for sure. And so many other lamas. I've met many, and they know what I'm up to. And I've only gotten encouragement. I've not heard one lama say, oh, what a stupid thing that Wallace is doing. Shamatha Vipassana, what a joke. You know, I've not heard one say that. It's been very positive. It's not about me at all. It has nothing really to do with this person, but what are we trying to do here? Yeah, that's it. That's what you need. I had a one-on-one conversation with Gajahn Rinpoche when I was with him in Arizona last January. Of course, this came up. I said, good. That's it. That's all the encouragement I need. Good. You know. So that's what's up. You might have wanted to know. People on the online course, we're not leaving you out. People here are not inner, they're not outer. There's no inner or outer. Devotion to Dharma, practicing Dharma, achieving Dharma. That's in. So let's go in. Find a comfortable position. Step by step, taking your time. Settle your body. Release the breathing. And settle your mind. Come to rest there for a little while, with no interest in, no deliberate focus upon any of the appearances to awareness, either sensory or mental. but simply rest in the flow of this most intimate knowing, the knowing of being conscious. Now open all the doors of your senses. Your eyes open. Let the light of your awareness flow out in all directions evenly. While remaining still, remaining in its own place, open all the doors of your perception to all appearances, while sustaining the flow of awareness, sustaining the stillness of your own awareness. Be aware without commentary, without labeling, without discursive thought, without objectifying or subjectifying. Rest in the simplicity of your awareness, discerningly clear, knowing itself and knowing the appearances that arise from moment to moment within the space of awareness. As you rest in the flow of awareness, it may become increasingly evident that there's no substance here, no awareness in and of itself. It's luminous, cognizant, and empty, arising relative to that which of which you are aware, arising relative to appearances. But it may be equally evident the appearances themselves. They are just that. They are appearances. They're empty. There's nothing behind them. There's nothing in them. They're appearances, empty appearances arising in space, relative to the awareness of them, as the awareness arises relative to them. Empty meets empty, and all luminous, clear. Rest in that simple flow of awareness, of seeing awareness as awareness, appearances and appearances, with no additions, no elaborations. Now a little bit of Vipassana. Out of sheer habit, there are bound to be activations of your mind, labels, discursive thoughts, conceptual imputations, are bound to arise. Identifying this, identifying that, objectively, subjectively. So while resting in awareness, with some breathing space between your awareness and the activities of the mind, observe the arising of conceptual designation, of labeling, of conceiving of objects out there and subjects in here, conceiving of there being a difference between outer and inner. Observe from the stillness of your awareness how your mind creates the world of objects and subjects in which you think you dwell. It's subtle, it's clear, it's on the top of the pyramid. It calls for great sharpness. Can you identify the basis of designation when you objectify anything? Can you identify what is imputed upon that basis? Can you see when it's merely a nominal designation without reification? And can you see when reification sets in and it grasps onto whatever has been identified as being really there or really here? Observe how the mind is indeed the basis of your samsara, this all-creating sovereign. Watch how this occurs, and you'll recognize delusive appearances as delusive appearances, and you'll no longer be deceived. You'll move from unawareness to awareness, the key to freedom. Let's continue practicing in silence. So in reference to that practice, you may recall an earlier statement by Dujum Lingpa, that if you probe inwards and seek to understand the nature of the empty nature of your awareness, that it cannot be established as anything at all. You can't find it as something real anywhere. If that doesn't work, it just doesn't prove effective for you, then, he said, then turn your attention outwards and realize the delusive nature of all appearances. That will take you to the same thing, same reality. So you can come to dependent origination by way of emptiness, or you can come to emptiness by way of dependent origination. They both work. Hola, so. So we've covered the ground. And now we move on, page 156, to the path. First full paragraph. When you're on the path. So you know, I think we should know now exactly what he's referring to, because he's speaking from his own experience. He's been through those phases of shamatha, vipassana. He's ascertained rikpa. He's fortifying, protecting, sustaining his awareness of awareness with his practice of vipassana, collapsing the false cave of appearances. And so he's on the path. So he knows exactly what he's talking about. This is amazing, you know. He's just telling you where he was, because he's actually moved on since then. But when you're on the path, when you have that ability to simply rest in the flow of rikpa, do not engage in even the slightest bit of intellectual examination of the mere nature of existence. Don't go back. If you're in fourth grade, don't go back to second grade. You've already covered that. Don't go retro. Just abide in this ongoing flow of awareness. Without any investigation, analysis, meditative practice, that is doing something with your mind, without any modification or alteration, relax within yourself in the essential nature. So that's where we're going. Reach this path, not only the entrance to the Mahayana path, he's on the path of Avidyadhara. Then when you're there, then simply relax within yourself in the essential nature. You know what that is. By loosely and completely resting there. I don't think you can make this any clearer or any stronger. Loosely and completely resting there, without your doing anything whatsoever, without striving, without trying to achieve anything at all, appearances of creative expressions will naturally flow forth. You know, these are the creative expressions of rikpa itself. They will naturally flow forth. They'll naturally flow forth in all of the six domains of experience. They will naturally flow forth, releasing themselves. They will self-emerge. They will self-release. You'll see that. You'll see all appearances as simply nothing other than effulgences of the pristine awareness in which you are resting. This is called illumination by primordial consciousness of the face of the great perfection of samsara and nirvana. In other words, you've arrived. You're on the path. All modification, alteration, hope, fear, doubt, negation, affirmation, grasping, exertion, investigation, and analysis are imputed by the intellect, the activities of the mind. And the intellect is not ultimate. What you're resting there is beyond the scope of the intellect. Shantideva Dundam Loyi Juyu Min, the ultimate is not in the scope of the intellect. It transcends the scope of the intellect. The ultimate, there he says, the ultimate transcends the intellect, so you must know this critical point. Don't try the imperialism, the intellect, which it's done all the time. It's done of the Western intellect imperializing everything, the rest of the world, but also all the traditions of the world. I've seen it in academia. It's complete imperialism, where you have your discipline, and then in complete colonialism, imperialism, you go out and you capture Buddhism. It's called Orientalism. A very good book was written on that topic years ago, where we come out and we gain conquest. And then we write our books about mysticism and Dzogchen. We conquest everything as if, you know, the intellect is the all-creating sovereign. It doesn't know its own limits, and it makes a fool of itself. So don't try any materialistic gimmicks with your intellect. It's not up to it. When you are utterly settled, you may fall into error. And while you are present in the aspect of emptiness, when you're simply resting there, thoughts may become hidden. And that is, there may be a gentle nudge. They may be hidden, a gentle nudge of a preference for thoughts not to arise. You may have experienced that already yourself. a preference for silence, a preference for emptiness, and thoughts may be nudged off to the side and hence become hidden. Thoughts may become hidden beyond the scope of the creative expressions of pristine awareness. So the activities of the mind may be lurking there. They're contaminating the pure vision of seeing all activities of the mind as nothing other than creative expressions of pristine awareness. Should this happen, that there's some residue of activities of the mind that are lingering there, infiltrating your practice because you fall into error. In this case, I say that thoughts become ethically neutral. In other words, they are not creative expressions of Rigpa, which is, you know, not even remotely ethically neutral. It's a display of Buddha mind, for heaven's sakes. But in this context, where you've erred a bit, then the thoughts that are lingering there, the activities of the sentient being's mind, I say that thoughts become ethically neutral in the boundary between the mind and pristine awareness. So what dimension of consciousness is in the boundary between mind and pristine awareness? Like exactly. When you're resting in the substrate consciousness, it said blissful, luminous, and non-conceptual. Not 100%. It's non-conceptual compared to where you were previously, but it's not entirely non-conceptual. Those thoughts that come up, they're still activities of a mind. And they can be like rust, a little bit like smog, still coming up. They're ethically neutral. They're not bad. They're not afflictive, but they're deviation from the practice. So exactly that, in that boundary between the mind and pristine awareness. So you're not seeing them as Rigpa itself, as the creative expressions of Rigpa. Not veering away from the nature of existence of the great perfection of samsara and nirvana is a sublime and utterly crucial point. So don't veer from that. Don't let it be contaminated by this infiltration, this habitual, tenacious infiltration of activities of the mind. With it, with this great vision, this great view, all gods and demons, and just generically everything positive and everything negative, all gods and demons and all of samsara and nirvana are liberated within themselves with no distinction of good and bad. When you dwell in Rigpa, you've transcended all of the eight extremes of conceptual elaboration. Of course, that includes good and bad. It is utterly transcending all the fabrications of the intellect. So that's the path. He's describing exactly what his experience is and how he has seen on occasion he does fall into error and how he returns. And then we turn to the fruition. On the occasion of extinction into ultimate reality. So this is a technical phrase, and it's really pertaining most closely to the Tutgel, the culminating phase of Dzogchen practice, where you have four visions that arise, one after another. The vision of the direct perception of reality, of the actual nature of reality, first one. So you're a vidyadhara, you're fully ripened vidyadhara. And then the growth or expansion, Rigpa Khompel, the Nyam Khompel, the development, the growth, the progress in meditative experiences. I won't elaborate, but that's the second one. It's related to another state of Vidyadhara, fifth, as I recall, on the fifth ground. And then the consummation, consummate pristine awareness. Very far along the path of Vidyadhara, even further. Fully ripened Vidyadhara. And then we have what? The second one. Oh yeah. Vidyadhara with mastery over life. You live as long as you want. That's the second vision. The third vision, Mahamudra Vidyadhara. Very far up. Eighth Bhumi, I think it is. But then the final one is the vision of the extinction into ultimate reality. Into Dhammata, Chunyat Zepe Nama, the vision, the appearance of all the appearances you've experienced, all the appearances in your mandala, all the appearances being extinguished in Dhammata. So all on the occasion of this fourth vision, this fourth culminating vision corresponding to the 10th Arya Bodhisattva Bhumi, corresponding to a spontaneously actualized Vidyadhara, the fourth and highest Vidyadhara. On that occasion, when you come to that point, all such appearances subside, they all dissolve, they fade away, they dissolve, they disappear. They subside into their own inner luminosity, the inner luminosity of Dharmakaya itself. Like the dissolution of illusory apparitions. You remember, like the young prince going off and see the great show? And imagine at the end of the show, all the appearances just evaporate. So it's like that, or it's like the moon in an empty sky vanishing into space. And it's as if the crystal light of unobscured primordial consciousness subsides within. Like all the light just withdraws right into primordial consciousness. And all impure appearances have dissolved. And from your perspective, they've dissolved, they've vanished irreversibly. From your perspective, that's it. Show's over. From your own perspective, activities for the sake of others are effortless. So now they just emerge spontaneously, effortlessly. Activities for the sake of all sentient beings. The radiance from the inner glow of the expanse manifests as the naturally unimpeded five Gayas, the fifth one being the Vajrakaya, and the five Buddha fields for each of the five Buddha families, and from them the creative expressions of compassionate Nimanakayas are self-emergent teachers who are the disciples' own perceptions. Give you some, just as sowing a seed, to imagining what must be going on at that point. So he's just told you the culmination of the path. And then he comes back to himself. He's finished now. He's told you the whole path. And then he comments on himself, this old man. He says, since I have not entered the treasury of hearing and reflection, he says, you know, I'm no great scholar. Don't even have one human guru. What can you do? I've not entered the treasury of hearing and reflection. I mean, there are many great scholars who are contemporaries to him. Vast learning. Unbelievable. Inconceivable. He's saying, I'm not one of them. I have not entered the treasury of hearing and reflection and have not served even one sublime spiritual mentor. Not even one human teacher. That being the case, I'm not skilled in composition. He's saying, I'm not educated. So please do not be dismayed with me. Please don't be upset. I'd probably just say, please don't be upset. If you find, you know, scholars reading this, who knows? They may find, I can imagine, maybe they find flaw with his writing style or whatever. He says, please don't be upset. I'm uneducated. What can I do? Didn't even have one teacher. Just a country boy. And he's finished. And then he's going to summarize this now, having laid it all out crystal clear. In prose, now he lays it out in verse. So this, I think, we can just go right through pretty much. Because there's nothing new now, except for a point here or there. So, but you see, I think is an expression of joy. Certainly not dismay. In originally pure absolute space, free of extremes, in the spontaneously actualized display of the palace of light, from the nature of non-dual bliss and emptiness, the conate embodiments of pristine awareness, Padmasambhava and Prahivatsara, or in Tibetan, Garab Dorje, are not mentally projected, but are the face of the nature of existence itself. These are not conjured up, these actual beings themselves, Padmasambhava, Garab Dorje. They are not something you conjure up. They are not your creation. Whatever comes to mind may be your creation, but these beings themselves, conate embodiments of pristine awareness, they are themselves the face of the nature of existence. They are embodiments of, expressions of, the nature of existence itself. From a state of non-exertion, I naturally meet them and receive the inheritance of the treasury of the expanse of ultimate reality. So he didn't have one sublime spiritual mentor except Padmasambhava and Garab Dorje in his pure visions. And that's where he received his treasury. Do not mistake these practical instructions for fantastic songs sung in the marketplace. Do not ruin yourself in order to slay others. And I think what he's getting at there is very deeply ingrained tendency. Our senses are all pointed outwards. We look outwards and we see faults. We see other people's degenerate behavior. We see other people's mental afflictions. We see injustice. We see samsara. And we see there's so much wrong that a natural inclination is, by gum, I'm going to roll up my sleeves and I'm going to fix things. I'm going to make this right. I'm going to go out there and correct other people's faults. Don't ruin yourself in order to slay others. Human life is like the melting sun at dusk. So do not engage in acts of deception which ruin you and others. The proliferation of scholarly acts of erudition involving lists and calculations is the threshold of pride, conceit, and false views. I've seen this in Western academia and also even, I've seen, in Asia. Some cases, I don't think they're all that common, I hope not, but occasionally I've seen people developing great erudition. And all it does is pump up their pride, their arrogance, a sense of self-importance, and then just false views. Amazing, I've seen so much erudition, and then they don't get anything. It's like reading menus and then eating the menus. Just makes you sick. Either because the achievement of liberation occurs within your own mind stream, or because the root of all dharma stems from your own mind stream. After you have spiritually matured, of course, this will benefit others as well. It's a very interesting phrase. It's worthy to come back to again and again. Because of the achievement of liberation within your own mind stream, there are yogis who will go off into solitude, into the remote regions of Amdo or up into the mountains and Kham and so on. They go and they just disappear. They're just gone, you know. And then that's it. Was there any benefit? Yeah, there it was. It occurs within their own lives. They're blessing in ways we can't even imagine. And then there are others who go very deep. They gain realization. And then the Dharma just flows from them spontaneously, like the great teachers like Dingbu Khyentse Rinpoche, Chogyi Tijin Rinpoche, and so many others, Ling Rinpoche, and so forth and so on. Just spontaneously flowing out of profound realization because of the profound spiritual maturation. So either way, whether you're a yogi who just disappears into the wilderness, or you're one who manifests the Dharma, of course this will benefit others as well. Once we've investigated our own foolish mind streams, we do not hope that our water drop will be able to relieve others. When we see the limitations of our own mind streams, the samsaric mind, clever, not so clever, knowledge, blah, 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 but saturated by, rooted in delusion, rooted in non-lucidity, exactly like being in a dream, and maybe you're the smartest person in the dream, and the most beautiful, the most articulate. Maybe you can do siddhis, you can do all kinds of amazing things in the dream. But if you're not lucid, your mind stream is foolish. And to think that with this mind stream that is rooted in getting everything wrong, because you're not knowing the nature of reality and you are getting it wrong. If you think the water drop of your mind is going to help others, you might want to think twice. We do not hope that our water drop will be able to relieve others. If we observe the five poisons, the attachments, and the aversions of our own mind streams, we do not hope that our compounded toxins will be nurturing medicines to protect others. So I've read so many great sages coming to this point. You know, we have this great urge, so many people do, and it's benevolent, it's good. What can you say? It's good, it's virtuous. Wanting to go out there and change the world. And then people like Dujom Lingpa says, why don't you just linger for a while and change the world within? Why don't you wake up? Why don't you wake up? And then see what needs to be done. Rather than carrying your toxins out into the world and thinking that's going to turn out well. Hey, if you rest without modification in self-emergent pristine awareness, the creator of samsara and nirvana is released in this one way. So do not seek the root of practical instructions elsewhere. and abandon every hope of achieving or acquiring results. In other words, he's saying, just stop. Just stop operating from the perspective of a sentient being where all you can do is hope for achieving and acquiring results because you haven't achieved them. And you think there's some out there, someplace out there in the future for you to get. Stop it. Abandon every hope. You who enter here, Dzogchen, leave all your hopes and fears behind. If you investigate the causal process of this and future lives and of days and nights, they are found to be delusive appearances of dualistic thoughts. So reveal the fallacy of the habitual propensity for mistakenly clinging to them as being autonomous. This is all clear, I think. Deeply and decisively fathom the full import of hearing and reflection. Do not think you can skip those and go directly just to sitting there in non-meditation. Don't be an idiot. If it were that simple, there wouldn't be any books on Dzogchen. They would just say, sit there, stupid. And that would be all of Dzogchen. Just sit there. That would be all. That's all you have to say. Sit there. Don't do anything. And we'd be finished. Then who needs to study Dzogchen? But we have all these texts. They're there to be heard, there to be reflected upon, to prepare us so that we do something more that a marmot cannot. Be skeptical of contrived meditations in which discursive thoughts are welcomed and followed. Don't be like those pathetic contemplatives who are caught in the middle, where the face of the nature of existence, the sun of the great perfection, is hidden by the clouds of deviations and obscurations of dualistic grasping. When I observe the many fluctuations of thoughts, I burst into laughter at the hope for the great perfection in them. To think that you're going to find Rigpa within thoughts. Good luck with it. Hey. Do not look for autonomous Buddhas. Apart from the essential nature, having no boundaries of the originally pure primordial ground. Same theme. Don't look for Buddhas outside yourself. All the false patterns of delusive experiences, externally and internally, of the physical world and its sentient inhabitants are wholly present in the expanse of the essential nature. This is our great perfection. In the unchanging, all-pervasive realm of bliss and emptiness arises the totality of displays of the vast, all-encompassing expanse where the sun of clear light rises without setting. Within an invulnerable fortress, a spontaneously actualized palace, this useless old man, as an embodiment of pristine awareness of ultimate reality, holds his own ground on an unshakable throne of inseparable, skillful means and wisdom, resting upon the corpses of mental afflictions. So he's just told you who he is. He didn't hold anything back. I don't understand due to explanations, nor do I realize due to teachings. My teacher is the lake-born Vajra, who granted me a cherished treasure of the inheritance of the enlightened view lineage. The enlightened view of lineage is Buddha mind to Buddha mind. So these appearances, these aspects of the lake-born Vajra that appear to him, they're always referring to him as an embodiment of pristine awareness. There's no talking down. There's talking across. They granted me a cherished treasure of the inheritance of the enlightened view lineage, which has no presentation or lists of the grounds and paths. I take the essential nature as the path. That is my patrilineal dharma. I am not bound by the reification of visualizations, recitations, worship and accomplishment. So this is probably going to come out in a later edition. This is not something that would have misled anybody, but I'm going to stick with the more standard translation of this Nyen Dup, and the more standard translation, which is accurate, is approach and accomplishment. For those scholars among you, Nyen Dup, approach, a bit more accurate. And so I will shift that next time. And I checked it in Tibetan dictionary. It really is. It's that accompanying. It's approaching. It's approaching the guru and then accomplishing, realizing the body, speech, and mind of the guru. It does entail propitiation, supplication. It does entail devotion and worship. It does entail that. But literally the word is simply to accompany, to approach, to come in the presence of. Okay? So I'm not bound. And this is classic practice within stage regeneration. So visualization, recitation, approach, and accomplishment. These are the bread and butter, the things you do in the state of regeneration practice. I'm not bound by the reification of visualizations, recitations, approach, and accomplishment, for my way is one of non-meditation, non-approach, and non-accomplishment. He's taking Rigpa as his path, not as something else as a path to Rigpa. My own grounding, transcending the intellect, is infinite, with no boundaries, without antidotes, modifications, alterations, or intellectual imputations, and uncontaminated by anything to observe, maintain, or investigate. Having released into openness, unstructured, without fabrication or referential object, in the yoga of inactivity, transcending good and bad, hope and fear, rejection and acceptance, there's wide open clarity with nothing to do. In the self-emergent expanse of originally present primordial consciousness, by transforming into the unmodified nature of loose release, the knots of dualistic grasping were directly dissolved. So now it's very autobiographical. He's telling what happened to him, what occurred. Once samsara and nirvana were purified as the Dharmakaya, the bonds of samsara and nirvana were cut from my heart. Once the darkness of unawareness vanished into empty awareness, the stake of attachment and clinging was wrenched up from its base. In the womb of unimpeded openness, the essential nature of non-objectivity destroyed and expelled identification with hopes and fears, joys and sorrows. In the absolute space of emptiness, the wisdom of identitylessness destroyed and expelled into oblivion the chains of self-grasping. As the expansive, enlightened view of Samantabhadra effortlessly flowed forth, I leapt to the state of a spontaneously actualized Vidyadhara. I leapt to the state. This is the connotation of Tut Gel. It's a leaping, it's a bounding from the first Arya Bodhisattva Bhumi to the fifth. You just jump right over, second, third, and fourth. You jump from the first Arya Bodhisattva Bhumi, from the stage of the first Vidyadhara, the fully matured, and you leap from there in the stage, this Tut Gel practice. It's a direct crossing over, it's a leaping over. He said, I leapt, as in leaping from the matured, fully matured Vidyadhara to the second stage of a Mahamudra. Tsela Wangwe, Tsela Wangyur, mastery over life. I remember in English, man, now better in Tibetan. I leapt then to the second state of Vidyadhara, on the fifth Arya Bodhisattva Bhumi. I leapt from there to the stage of a Mahamudra Vidyadhara, eighth Arya Bodhisattva Bhumi. And now he's saying, here is an old man, towards the end of his life, he's coming to tell you what happened finally. I leapt to the state of a spontaneously actualized Vidyadhara. That's the highest state. And he said, I did that. That's where I live. He leaped from the first to the fifth, from the fifth to the eighth, from the eighth to the tenth. Final stage. That's why I leapt. So he's telling you who he is, what he's realized. May all sentient beings throughout space who see, hear, recall, or touch me encounter their own essential nature as self-emergent kayas of pristine awareness and definitely come to the expanse of Samantabhadra. Colophon, how did this text come about? In response to the earnest request of by the sublime Guru Sunampalden, a relative of Dodrupa Rinpoche, the foolish idiot Sakutsipa Dujum Dorje Tolutsel uttered this foolish dharma of an idiot clothed in mud and feathers. That's his text. And then the great Dujum Rinpoche, Kepche Dujum Rinpoche, he, being the consummate scholar, unbelievable scholar, is erudition and addition, of course, to realization. Then he edited, he fine-tuned, he proofread an edition of these collective works of Dujum Lingpa. And so he writes his own colophon as the editor. Why we have such a clean copy here? This is due to Dujum Lingpa's mind emanation, polishing his own work from the past life. So Dujum Rinpoche writes this final prayer. This well-bestowed, unique, ultimate teaching on the vital core of the enlightened view of Samantabhadra, the essence of pith instructions concerning the effortless supreme jnana, The great Ati perfection, great perfection, the primordial consciousness of the Dharmakaya, has been nakedly placed in your hands. So he's speaking to all of us here. That's what just happened. In order to burst the fine, pretentious bubbles of the intellectually fabricated meditations of fools, seize this all-sufficient golden needle of pith instructions and dispense with the elaboration of a multitude of practices. O fortunate assembly, come to the ground of primordial liberation. So it seems from the next line here that he needed, there were some sponsors for him to feed him and so on when he was doing this editing. So he refers to them here. For this purpose, the king and queen of Sikkim, of divine ancestry, opened the unlocked door to a feast of sacred relics of pith instructions. You who seek liberation, come for your portion of the ambrosia that dispels misery. So with them as his patrons, he came out with this edited version of all the, I think it's 18 volumes of Dujum Limba's works. And so partake. By the power of stainless merit, may all beings become vessels for the profound and secret great perfection. And having dredged the depths of samsara in the expanse of the extinction into ultimate reality, may the whole world come to the equal taste of great bliss of Samantabhadra. So that's his prayer. And then he concludes with his own colophon. In order to fulfill the wish of a pure practitioner, Jigdel Yeshe Dorje, the personal name of His Holiness Dujum Rinpoche, uttered these verses for a later edition of the text. May this serve as a cause for this precious teaching of the mind of Samantabhadra to be as enduring and pervasive as space. Sarva Mangalam. And that concludes the oral transmission and commentary. So it is my earnest desire, wish, hope, that I've not distorted it in any way, but I can say I've done my best. So there it is. So, Sarva Mangalam. See you.